has been a home group member of ours for, I want to say, a year or more, a little bit more than a year. He's a home group member. He's going to speak tonight. His name is Bob.
Okay, I'm Bob and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
But more importantly, I'm a child of God. Okay. My sobriety date is November 10th, 2023. I have a sponsor. He knows he's my sponsor, even though he doesn't want to know it sometimes. He's got a sponsor, and so on and so on. Like Jake said, this is my first time speaking. No preparation time. It was like mid-afternoon when they said, asked me to do it, and I said, "Yeah, okay, we're gonna go ahead and just roll with it." Okay, so start from the beginning. Okay, my parents, they were raised in a little town outside of San Antonio, Texas, Floresville, Texas. It is southeast of San Antonio, about 40 miles. My dad joined the Navy. I've got three older sisters. They were born throughout the United States. And I was born in Great Lakes. Now, we didn't spend a whole lot of time there because it was just a training facility. So we moved to Virginia Beach when I was a year old. And in the neighborhood I moved, it was a brand new neighborhood. Everybody that lived there was military, either Marines or Navy. And I don't know how it is now, but back in that day, every time one or more of those individuals got together, there was alcohol, there were cigarettes, and there were cigars. Guys in the military now, I don't know if it's the same way, but that's the way it was back then. So, growing up in that environment, it always looked like that is what the adults did. Okay, so as a kid, that's what you think. You think, okay, when I get to be an adult, this is what I get to do. So, you know, my parents, my dad had a huge problem with alcohol. My mother, she was a moderate drinker. There were times where she was a little bit excessive, but my dad definitely. And the part of the story when I was in the fifth grade, it was April 3rd, 1980. And I remember this like it was yesterday. I got called down to the principal's office. I don't know how your school went, but if you get called to the principal's office, it's something that you did. Unfortunately, I didn't have anything in my mind that would require me to go to the principal's office. So anyway, I walk in and my next door neighbor is sitting next to the principal, but none of my family was there. So when I go in and they tell me that my father had a boat, he was in a boating accident and he was in the hospital. As a 10-year-old child, the first thing that I thought of was, I hope he can get help for his alcoholism, or his, you know, his problem with alcohol. Unfortunately, when we got home, we got the news that he had passed. Now, the reason I tell you guys this is because a couple weeks later, when my parents were separated at the time, and he was going to move back home, didn't get the opportunity to, but when we were moving him out, he had these books, and I remember it just as plain as something I did this morning. I picked up this big blue book with no writing on the front, with an embossed Alcoholics Anonymous on it. And that stuck with me, for I will never forget picking that up and looking at it. Not that it really meant anything to me at the time. Now, my first experience with alcohol was when I was 12. we were in Texas during the summertime visiting family, and it was a barbecue, and there were lots of people there I didn't know. They were all my family, but I didn't know any of them, about 100 of them. And the thing that all the kids did was they got beers for their parents. They would go fill the beers up in the kegs and bring them to their parents. Well, I was like, okay, I'll do it. Drink. Didn't really have that much, but after about two cups, I was like, this is pretty cool. Now I understand why they wanted to do it. Shortly after that, we got all the cousins had, the younger kids got together. I had a cup and we were around the corner and we got busted. Did we get in trouble? No. They just told us, just dump it out. Just dump it out. That was it. So I was like, okay. So that was my first experience with alcohol. It was a good experience. Now, a couple months later, when we get back home, my mother's at work. My two older sisters already moved out because they're way older than, there's like a 10-year gap in between the two sets of siblings. And so I'm home alone. I'm home alone. Mom's at work. My sister's doing something. I don't know what she was doing. And then I'm like, you know what? I remembered that beer. But it was too obvious to actually get a beer out of the fridge. So in my mind, I said liquor cabinet. Well, being a 12-year-old kid, you have no idea what that liquor is going to do to you. You have no idea how much you need to drink. So after about six swigs of it, immediately, about 3 minutes later, I started feeling, I was like, this is really cool. And then I got a little wobbly. I was like, I don't know how cool this is. I have no idea how cool this is. And then I started getting nauseous. And then I started throwing up. So and I was throwing up everywhere. So the entire house smelled like vodka vomit. And then I hear the garage door open up. I'm dead. There's nothing I can do. So what do? You play dead. Probably not the best idea. But she got me back. She made me go to school the next day with the worst hangover I think I've ever had in my life. So so that's my introduction to alcohol. Now I was a little younger than most of the kids in my grade. I was almost a full year younger. So our high schools were separated 10 to 12, and we had a junior high school, which was 7 through 9. So when I got to high school, I played football, so I met all these seniors, okay? Well, in Virginia at that time frame, the year previous, they had some weird grandfather clause where you could buy beer and wine at 18 and liquor was 21, but it was grandfathered in, so it was like a moving mark. So nobody in the school could actually buy beer and wine, but they knew people that had just graduated that could. So we always had a full supply of that. And the worst part about it was my mother knew and trusted every one of the guys I was hanging out with that were seniors in high school. Bad choice. One of the guys, his father worked for the newspaper and was, he's a sports reporter. And he was always, he had been out of town for like 10 weeks. Where were we for 10 weeks? We were at his house. So that was all fun and games. And it just kind of continued throughout my high school career. Nothing major ever happened. It was all just drink on the weekends. We would even go, a friend of mine, we'd just go and sit in the parking lot and drink. It was drink. That's all it was. And then after my senior year, after the football season, I can still remember, it was like in January, I get this phone call, and guy calls me up, he's like, hey, you want to come play football for us? I was like, who are you and where are you calling from? He goes, this is Larry Creekmore, I'm calling from Virginia Tech. I was like, okay, we've never talked before. He's like, yeah, no, we saw your film, we want you to come and play for us. We need you to get this, and it was like so matter of fact. He's just like, you got to give me your transcripts and stuff so you can get in. I was like, coach, I'm already in. I've already been accepted. He's like, what? I said, yeah, I've already been accepted. I was a pretty good student at that time frame. So I ended up going to Virginia Tech. That is when it really started to be heavy for me. 17 years old, playing college football with much, much older guys, and they all liked you to hang around. It's kind of like a fraternity mindset. You know, get us this, do this, a little bit of hazing here, a little there, but you get to hang out with us. Everybody knows us, you're gonna be part of the group. Okay. Not a big deal. Now I was redshirted my freshman year, meaning I didn't play, but I was on the team. And I proved myself pretty good. Whereas there were, you know, mentions in newspaper articles about possibly pulling me up because they were struggling in certain parts of the offensive line, and it made me feel good. My biggest problem was weight. Most people say that because they're too big. I was losing too much weight. They made me sign in for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They made sure I was eating, which wasn't a problem. They should have just made me drink and drink more. But anyway, and during that season, right before one of the home games, me and a couple other guys, we decided we were going to go to the liquor. We all had fake IDs. We were going to go to the liquor store and get this stuff. You know, I'm sure everybody's heard of grain alcohol. One of the biggest mistakes I've ever made in my life was taking double shots of grain alcohol. I have no idea what happened that night. Only what was told to me. Part of it is me without my clothes on in the middle of the dorm while people are everywhere. Did it happen? I'm sure it did. I don't remember it. But I do remember getting called in the morning to go see the trainer of the team. And he looked at me and he was like, man, you look pretty chipper. I said, I feel fine. He goes, yeah, you probably won't later. And I remember, and I didn't even remember the guy's name, I had to show a recruit around that morning. And right before he left, they said that my face just turned green. Just went green. But that was kind of me at the time. That was the excess of just trying to outdrink everybody. Just didn't care what happened, just did it. And after the season was over, it got worse. And then after that season, I was on a mandatory academic timeout. Other people call it a suspension, but that's what I call it, mandatory academic timeout. So I came home for that year. I had no intention of going back. So I came back, started working, and I figured out working in the telecommunications field with the company I was working for, pulling telephone cable underneath Newport News Shipbuilding, up in buildings, just pulling huge cable, that wasn't for me. That sucked. That was horrible. It was an absolutely horrible job. So I decided I was going to go back to school. So I went back to school. And after a while, the coach my offensive line coach and me just got into it, and I just decided I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not going to bust my tail, and you're not going to do anything. So that night was the night where I went on probably a year and a half binge. I just started drinking every single night. Being as big as I was, I got to work in bars. I was 280 pounds at that time, so I got to work in bars and bounce. That was a great thing. Right there with it. I mean, you got open access to it. So I came to a realization after a little while that this wasn't working here, so I left Blacksburg, came back home. Started school again, got focused on school, was doing really good. Went to Tidewater, got my grades up. And while I was in Tidewater, I joined a political club, which was kind of neat. And we were working with all the local candidates and stuff, so you got really tied into the whole political thing. And the good thing for me is, on the political side of it, they may drink at the victory party, but almost all the other time, you're drinking coffee. Because you need to stay awake, because you need to put up signs, you need to put out flyers, you need this, that. So we're just drinking coffee. That was my introduction to coffee. To this day, I still drink coffee. Try not to drink it at night anymore, it's starting to keep me up, but drink coffee as soon as I wake up, and that was my introduction to that beverage, which was cool. You know, it kept me straight, kept me mentally straight, mentally clean. My grades were almost perfect. Then I transferred into Old Dominion, and then they had this crazy idea that they wanted all political groups think about is power. So they want to figure out what they can do to gain power. So what they wanted to do, they wanted me to, since I was at Old Dominion, join a fraternity and use that fraternity as a group, a working group, to take over the student government. Well, so I said, okay. I became part of the fraternity. Didn't worry about the political group anymore. We went right back to the fun. We went back to the alcohol, we went back to the fun, the parties, the fun, and everything. And there were a couple instances there where it was kind of crazy. But no, I was still keeping it together. And then there was a point where people entrust me with a lot of stuff to do. They really didn't give me the support to get it done, so it kind of failed. And I've had this fear of failure, especially when it's happening. That was when I was picking up the bottom. So when that happened, it fell apart, and I was nowhere to be found because I was inside the bottle. Then I had one guy that took me and shook me, and he got me out of it, because my entire life is an ebb and flow, the alcohol. Then he shook me, he got it out of me. I kind of woke up a little bit. I was still working in a bar. I was bartending at the time. But I wasn't really drinking that much. I was really working. And I met a girl, and she kept me straight. She drank a heck of a lot more than I did. But it was easy for her because I was working. She could just put it on my tab. Well, anyway, we ended up getting married while I was working at the bar. I just stopped signing up for classes and just working. And we ended up getting married, and she ended up getting pregnant. 2 weeks before we had our first kid, I was still working at the bar, and I got a job offer somewhere in Chesapeake, working in a production facility. as a supervisor. I jumped at it. I jumped right out of it. Now, in the next 24 years, I'm just going to skip over because nothing happened. I had no episodes. I was busy. I was always in my kid, and then the second kid happened. I was always in their lives. I was always doing things. Wasn't a problem. Now, when my oldest son went away to school, I started drinking again. Beer's never an issue for me. I would always jump to the liquor. The liquor was quicker, and it tended to dull it quick, you know, dull the pain quickly, whatever pain I was feeling at the time. So I started drinking again. I started having liquor in the house right before he went away to school. And then we're moving him into his dorm room, and we get a phone call from my niece. And I didn't even think twice about it, but my wife picked up the phone, and she's like, "What's wrong?" Well, my youngest son decided he was going to do what I did with the vodka, but he did it with bourbon. And my niece was terrified. And I'm like, "He'll be okay. He'll be hating it tomorrow, but he'll be okay." She goes, "Well, I'm going to keep watching him." I said, "I expect you to, but he'll be fine." I didn't even really think about that because it was something that I did, so it wasn't something that I focused on. And I think the lessons that child got from me, he's not gonna put himself into that situation. The worst thing that could possibly happen to me was COVID. I had been, my entire career, I'd always been in person with people, and I really enjoyed that. The moment that I got stuck at home, because I really, at that point, I did not really like the job I was doing, so it was even worse that I had to do it on a computer and do it at home. What's at home? Hey, there's bottles here. Now, it started like towards the end of the day, and then it started picking up, getting earlier and earlier and earlier, and then it started being, "Man, I feel like heck when I wake up. I need one right now. Get me through the day." And it got pretty severe. And then right there in, so that was August of 2020, I don't know what the heck happened, but I drank so much that my wife had called the ambulance to take me to the hospital because I was that drunk, telling her that I'm going to hurt myself and stuff, and the police came. And then, you know, I think I'm slick. Cop asked me, he's like, "Are you going to hurt yourself? Are you going to kill yourself?" I said, "I wasn't planning on it, but I don't care if it happens." And he's like, "We can't take him." I'm like, "What?" Okay, so I play that one right. And eventually I just said, "Whatever, I'll go to the hospital, whatever." Well, it'd been about 10 hours since I had a drink. My blood alcohol content was still 0.2. So the doctor looked at me and said, "You're lucky you're alive. You are lucky you are alive." So they ended up sticking me in that, I don't even know what you call it, that area with the, with all the, things you can hurt yourself taken away. I guess it's a behavioral health unit, whatever, just to dry out. And what does an alcoholic do? Man, these people are crazy. I was just drunk. These people are crazy. Get me out of here. So what do? You sit there, you tell a doctor what they want to hear. I was great at that. Tell them you're going to do what they want you to do. I was good at that too. You know, you go through the little sessions, little meetings, everything, just let them know that you're okay. And then I made a decision during that time frame that I was going to, you know, I was going to try to sober up. And like I said, that was August, so it was right at the beginning of September when I got out of there. Didn't have another drink until February 14th. February 14th. Of 2021. Why did I have a drink? Because on Valentine's Day, my wife gave me cooking utensils. That is what drove me to drink again. She gave me cooking utensils, which made a heck of a lot of sense to her because I was the one that always cooked. What it meant to me was, you don't love me. You just want me to cook. So, guys, don't give cooking utensils for Valentine's Day. It can go really poorly. Anyway, so I went on a binge again, drank. That went on, and you know, then I got this wild idea because we're coming out of COVID that I'm going to start driving an Uber because I want to talk to people. I want to see people. But nobody told me that I shouldn't drink while I do that. But I was good. I was good. I was driving people around drunk as hell. I mean, you think about it now, you can chuckle at it, but man, that takes some balls. You know, and then on New Year's Eve, I go out. I'm like, I'm going to stay sober, right? Well, about 11 o'clock, I dropped by some store and just got, you know, those big, like fruit punchy, liquor-y type drinks. I chugged a couple of those. And I still tell myself to this day, I didn't wreck the car because I was drunk. I wrecked the car because I fell asleep. Which I think both of them are true. But anyway, that was a thing I think about to this day, because I remember they were doing the construction on the high-rise bridge and I slammed into the Jersey wall because I fell asleep and slammed into it. Pretty much tore the entire side of my vehicle off and proceeded to pull over to the side of the road. And then I fell asleep. Now, the most bizarre thing happened after that. I opened my eyes, there's a police officer standing by the door. I rolled the window, the passenger side window worked. I rolled the window down. He goes, "You okay?" I said, "Yes, sir." Now, this time, let me tell you, I peed all over myself. There's cans everywhere. He's like, "Come on, you need to get out of the car." So he opened the door. And I looked at him, I said, "I think I know you." He's like, no, you don't know me. And I'm like, "I think I know you." He goes, no, you don't know me. So I ended up getting out of the car. He just went back to the car. Unbeknownst to me, the only thing that happened to me that night was a tow truck was called. I got in that tow truck and we left. That's it. I slammed my car into a Jersey wall, drunk as hell, and that's what's happened to me. I ain't in trouble at all. Even better, you just lie to the insurance company. "Oh yeah, somebody cut me off and I hit the wall." It worked. So, no consequences from that. The very next day was my first day in my first stint of AA. Went in, went to a meeting out in Great Bridge on Man. Picked up a white chip. It's when I first met Jake out there, because Jake went to that meeting. I don't know if it was that night or the week after, but you came to that meeting really close to that point. And that's when you told me about this meeting out here. You didn't even remember that? You ever been to that meeting?
Which meeting?
The one on Man in Great Bridge.
Yeah.
It's a men's meeting.
I never go to that meeting.
You never go? You never been?
I've been there, but maybe once.
That was the time I saw you, and oh, you told me to come out here. And tell me God doesn't work in mysterious ways. So, anyway, that worked for a while until I figured out that I could do, didn't need a sponsor, I just do it by myself. That doesn't work. Works for a little while, but doesn't work for good. So I started drinking again. And then everything fell apart. My wife and I hated each other for many, many different reasons. Drinking was only one of them. But I was, at that point, she said she was going to leave me. She meant it, but she wasn't leaving. She was going to leave me in the house. So I pretty much lived on the couch. And started drinking Jim Beam right out of the bottle with no chaser. No ice, just right out of the bottle. And I really looked like John Belushi in Animal House at a point where he would just turn it up and just chug it. That's what I was doing. When I was young, I thought it was ridiculous, but no, it's not. You can do it. You can work yourself into there. And then when she finally walked out the door, it was November 7th. I slowly started thinking. I had a lot of time to think because nobody was there. My kids were gone. They were out of the house. Everybody left me. I was completely isolated. So all I had to do was think. Put down the bottle on November 10th. That was when I asked God to save me. You know, I'd known God before that point, and it was more of a head knowledge. But at that point, even before I walked back in here, I asked Him, "You got to save me. I can't do it by myself. You got to take care of me." So when I walked back in here, I was kind of a little squeamish about coming back the first time. You're like, these guys are going to remember me, and they're going to know that I went out and drank again. You know, it was absolutely not that at all. They welcomed me back in immediately, open arms. I still... I'm trying to figure out how I got a sponsor without asking for one, but that's cool. Because I remember Steve goes, "Go talk to him." So I walked over. I said, "Hey, how you doing? Steve told me to come here and talk to you." And then he started giving me assignments. And I'm like, okay. And then before I walked out, I went, "Does this mean you're my sponsor?" He goes, "That's what you're asking for, right?" I said, "Not really, but but that's cool." So, you know, we started doing daily calls. You know, we got real relaxed now. We only talk on the weekdays. We take our weekends off. We do need a break from each other a little bit. But I know that He's there if I need Him, and I'm there if He needs me. It's a strange dual relationship it turns into. So when I asked God to come into my life and save me, it wasn't immediate, but I can tell you, staying consistent staying in the books, keeping my mind straight. After about 3 months, everything kind of cleared up. I got mental clarity back where I could see some of the mistakes I was making. And I constantly now ask God to show me what He needs me to do. And a lot of people think that's a little bizarre, but He answers, maybe not verbally, but through signs, through thoughts, through random occurrences. He's answering my questions. He's giving me direction. You know, one of the, there's an individual in this room that I told this story to once, and he didn't like it so much because he thought it was factually incorrect. But you know, just an example is one time I was going to officiate a sand soccer tournament, and for anybody that's ever done sand soccer, it's probably the most unimportant tournament of the year. Has no meaning or consequence to anything, but they act like it is the most important, and people take it super serious, and it's just ridiculous. So when I was driving out there, the first thing in my mind is, God, I'm gonna have to deal with these people. And I was like, God, how am I gonna deal with these people? And I come around the corner, and there's a bald eagle grounded on the median on Dock Landing Road, just sitting in the median. I thought it was a turkey vulture at first, but when I got close, I could tell it was a bald eagle. It's huge. And my God, I've never seen a bald eagle grounded there or anywhere on the ground. I've seen them in trees and seen them flying, but I've never seen one on the ground. So when I got closer to it, it flew off, huge wingspan. And then I see this black bird start attacking it. And I'm like, okay, God, I got it. Many years ago, there was a story that I was told about an eagle and a crow. And the crow is the only bird that will attack an eagle. And what the eagle does, it doesn't fight back. It just gains altitude to the point where the crow can't breathe anymore and falls off. Because, you know, it can go higher. So basically the whole concept of it is just to raise yourself above the crows, the little things that bother you on a consistent basis. Just rise above it. You have the ability through your higher power and the things you learn in this room with people in these rooms and, you know, experiences here, to just rise above it. And at that point in time, that spoke to me. Absolutely, I knew exactly what it meant. And it ended up being a pretty good day. I have hundreds of those experiences. There was one time I pulled up in the church and felt like hell. Back up, I never back in when I park, and then it was cloudy. And then I look up and the clouds part and the sun comes right across the top of the steeple up here, right in my vision. And I went, okay, I got it. You know, things happen all the time. But I guess, you know, one of the coolest things is that this program has really got me back into my faith, rededicated myself to my faith. I know religion isn't part of it, but it is part of it for me. So everybody's got their own version of it, but that's mine, and it's got me back into it full-fledged. I was it, originally baptized in, what year was that? It was 2008, and it was at a revival. I thought it was important for myself because I didn't really think about it then, or think about the consequences of what I was doing, that I'd do it again. So I ended up doing it a month ago. It's crazy that I'm in the place I'm in right now. Mentally, I'm probably as content and full of peace as I've been maybe ever. Maybe ever. And it's just, when I think back, it's kind of amazing. Now, everything doesn't happen overnight. It's not a right turn. It's a slow walk. You take it as it comes, but you use the principles that you learn and your higher power to get you through it. And the amazing people that I've met here and along the way that I can look back on, and the stories I've heard, have all been put together to keep me from going back into that bottle. The amazing part is right now, I rarely think about it, but every once in a while, does anybody get that thought in their head where they're like, you know, I could probably take a drink right now. But now I have the ability to go, that is the dumbest thought that I've had all day long. So, yeah, I appreciate y'all asking me to speak. Maybe next time I tell you the other 250 stupid stories I have. Maybe some of them with my clothes on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bob, thank you so much.